because we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're back, we're dads on the air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air this Tuesday, the 6th of December 2011. And this is Bill Cable from Mediate Now. And in the studio with me this morning is Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning, Bill. Good morning, listeners.
And we've got a big show today. We'll be breaking the silence. Our first guest today is Dr. Elizabeth Chelley, who has recently released her new book. This is her second book. This book is called Breaking the Silence, A Practical Guide for Male Victims of Domestic Abuse, and it deals with her clinical experience with the abuse of men. As it says in the title, this is a topic that's been kept under wraps for far too long, and Elizabeth is about to break that silence and give us some very practical information. So we'll be talking to Elizabeth a little bit later.
Yes, just kind of unfashionable sort of a subject, really, that violence towards men. Nobody seems to want to talk about it at all. Nobody wants to acknowledge that it can happen or it does happen.
Yeah, so if you're looking for an unusual Christmas present, how about buying Breaking the Silence from Dr. Elizabeth Chelley? And later on, we'll be speaking with Emily Tilbrook, who is the lead author in a report that was done in 2009. And at the time, we did speak to one of her co-authors. And this report is on the intimate partner abuse of men, and was a resource that Dr. Chelley used in preparing her book. So it'll be great to speak to, as I say, the lead author of that report. That's Emily Tilbrook, and we'll be speaking to her a little bit later in the show as well. So before we get on with the interviews, as usual, there are a few items in the newspapers that always seem to catch our eye. And the first one I wanted to mention is from The Australian, and this was the weekend edition. And there's an article by Caroline Overington, who I must say is these days seems to be taking a very balanced approach.
Yeah, she's making a lot more sense these days than she used to, that's for sure.
She's recently produced some novels, so perhaps in the research that went into those novels, it has maybe influenced her attitude to the whole area. But in any event, she has written an article here, which is a shameful story, really. It's an interesting one, a shameful one, it's everything. But in this case, there is a reverse of what normally happens when property is divided in the family court, in that in this case, there was a man and a woman who were divorced after 21 years. And when the court went to divide up the assets, they found that the wife had done most of the earning, but nevertheless, in the reverse situation where it's often the man that's done most of the earning and the woman starts off looking for something like 70% of the assets. In this case, the wife was allowed to keep the bulk of the $4 million in assets she held in her name while leaving the husband with pretty much nothing. So this was a situation where Brisbane Magistrate Michael Bowman said, virtually critical of the husband, saying that he had real estate and a boat which depreciated in value, and
so that was his fault.
Well, it appears, because the court made this strange statement that it would be a form of social engineering to take money from the wife and give it to the husband merely because they went through the act of marriage in 1991.
Oh, good Lord. That sounds very sexist, doesn't it? I mean, to put the boot on the other foot or the dancing shoe on the other foot, I mean, how that's nonsense.
Yes, I mean, it's certainly you can't imagine if this situation were reversed, where the court would say, "Oh, we can't do any social engineering. We can't take any money."
There's a whole industry based around basically transferring wealth from men to women.
Yep.
So. And you know, the thought of actually some of it coming back the other way is horrifying to them. I mean, how incredible! That's amazing.
Yes, so anyway, Mr. Bowman has come up with that decision, and it was deemed worthy enough to warrant an article in The Australian by Caroline Overington. So,
what did Caroline say? What was her slant on it?
Caroline didn't didn't, I suppose, give an opinion on it, only just pointed out the facts, which is probably enough. She did ask a few questions. Yeah. She said, in the usual situation, when a man gets divorced, he's going to lose a chunk of whatever fortune he has made to his ex-wife. And then she poses the question, what if it's the wife who has made all the money? Does she lose half too? Well, the answer is no, if you follow this particular decision by Mr. Bowman.
Well, that's ridiculous, because, I mean, where's the equality? I mean, that's all just nonsense. Here we go, female privilege, and once again is, you know, shored up, and whatever men, you know, whatever rights we have are basically flushed down the toilet one more time.
Yeah, see, I think there is a trend going the wrong way at the moment.
No, it's disgraceful.
In the courts and in the government.
That's disgusting. That's just sexist nonsense.
So, Ian, you got
okay. Well, this is a little bit more cheery. Secret is to get them while they're young is the heading. This was in the Sun Herald last Sunday. Good eating habits from an early age can help prevent eating disorders, writes Rachel Brown. Teaching children to have a healthy relationship with food from a young age can reduce the likelihood of them developing an eating disorder. This means teaching them that food is fuel for the body rather than a reward or punishment, says Christine Morgan, chief executive of the eating disorders support group, the Butterfly Foundation. The pressures on children are starting younger, she says. They are aware of body image at a younger age. It really is imperative to get that healthy attitude right from the get-go. Ms. Morgan has noticed an increase in the number of children diagnosed with early onset eating disorders, which can start from as young as 8, which is pretty shocking. Now, the Sun Herald is about to embark on a campaign of healthy habits, a healthy eating habits campaign about childhood obesity, which is supported by the Children's Hospital and will cover critical topics in the coming weeks, including the pester power of children and sedentary lifestyles, and shows families 7 practical steps to become more active and making better food choices. And this is essential because it really does appear that the food chain has been completely taken over by corporations and is now really more a subject of corporate profit than it has got anything to do with health or nutrition, which is what food used to be about. But these days you've really got to protect yourself and your family from the nonsense that is being marketed out there in the name of healthy eating substances, you know, which are in fact basically trans fats, salt and sugar, which is what a lot of what our children are being subjected to, and of course pester power and advertising to children during television, children's television hours, is all adding to the problem. So there you go.
Okay. Also, I suppose on the positive side, there's in the US, a very prestigious journal has recently given some positive reviews on to 3 books on parental alienation. This is an article by Robert Franklin in fathersandfamilies.org, and he comments that the discussion of parental alienation has taken a step forward with the publication of 3 books and positive reviews of these books in the prestigious Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. The review is by Dr. Gabriel Shapiro, MD, and she, in reviewing the books, she's actually given a little bit about her own development, and states that when she first was going through her training in psychiatry, the concept of parental alienation was a subject of great contention and debate, and there was a lot of emotion around it. But she's admitted that after working for many years performing custody evaluations, that she, in her words, bought into the diagnosis, recognizing not only its existence, but also its devastating and long-lasting impact on the development and attachments of children who are victims of high-conflict divorce. The books in question, the first one is called Parental Alienation, DSM-5 and ICD-11, is written by Dr. William Burnett, or I suppose more accurate to say he's edited it. He's gathered articles and commentary from 70 mental health researchers and practitioners worldwide, as well as citations to some 630 articles on the subject. Now, listeners might be aware that we did speak to Dr. Burnett. That was at the end of last year. So you can go back in our archives and listen to that interview again. That was a great interview with Dr. Burnett. He's a he's a leader in this field and an absolute inspiration to people working with parental alienation. So that's his book. You can also get his book on Amazon. It is a professional book. It's reasonably expensive, I suppose, for that reason. But if you Google parental alienation, Dr. William Burnett, B-E-R-N-E-T, you'll get a link to that book. The other books that were mentioned were there was a book also reviewed by the Journal. It was less of a scientific treatise and more of a narrative of one man's experience of parental alienation at the hands of his ex-wife. The narrative is that of Michael Jeffries, who kept a meticulous journal of his own alienation from his children. But the other half of the book consists of observations by his psychotherapist, Dr. Joel Davies. Now, this book is called A Family's Heartbreak, A Parent's Introduction to Parental Alienation, and the author is Michael Jeffries. It gives a kind of a stereoscopic view of the matter, part personal story, part scientific analysis. Of course, the reviewer points out it's only one man's story and his alienating wife's side is never told. But still, the reviewer recommends it exactly because the book shows the agony of the target as well as a clinician's view of the parental alienation. And I'd have to say, if you go back to Dr. Richard Gardner's studies in this area and anyone who's had any experience in the area, they will tell you that there is an enormous similarity in these cases where there's parental alienation. Dr. Gardner identified 7 factors to look for, and it's amazing how in many of these situations all 7 of them are present. So although it is only one man's story, it's nevertheless a guide to the whole field. The third book reviewed is not so much a medical or a scientific book. It's a novel about parental alienation. The characters are fictional, as is the action of the book, and therefore the work provides not too much of scientific interest, but it still may serve to put the reader in the shoes of an alienated parent and start to understand what is going on in this area that is recognised in the US. There are many books written, there are seminars held, there are international seminars held, and the courts will more often than not recognise parental alienation. It just shows what a long way we've got to go in Australia before parental alienation gets the attention it deserves.
Absolutely, because it's incredibly damaging. Now, just getting back to Rachel Brown and the Sun Herald campaign on childhood obesity, she's also written another article in the very same Sun Herald last Sunday, Triple Threat of Too Much Screen Time. She has written, a generation ago, the worst threat to a television-loving child was developing square eyes. Today, a child who spends too much time in front of the television or computer is at higher risk of becoming overweight or obese and potentially facing a lifetime of health problems. A senior policy advisor with the Obesity Policy Coalition, Jane Martin, said children who spent an excessive amount of time on the computer or watching television were exposed to more marketing, much of it subliminal. In the case of programs like Junior Master Chef or It's a Knockout, the marketing is embedded in the show, Ms. Martin said. It's quite subtle. Similarly, websites marketing food to children such as McDonald's, Happy Meals and Paddle Pops tempt young people with games and competitions. It's about repeat visits. It's about keeping the children on for as long as they can. They don't realise they are being sold to. 30% of Australians now subscribe to pay TV, which offers a slew of dedicated children's channels, while 72% of homes have a computer offering a plethora of viewing possibilities. And they've offered here a TV guide for concerned parents. The first thing they advise is turn on the TV only for a specific show you want to watch, and once it's finished, switch it off. The second thing they advise is allow TV only once chores or homework are done. Thirdly, give children advanced warning before their TV time is about to finish for the evening. Fourthly, keep the computer in a public area of the house. Fifthly, don't give younger children their own passwords. And finally, give children a specific amount of time on the computer, for example, 1 hour. Once their hour is up, turn the computer off. So that, I think, is sensible advice. The proportion of children who spend more than 2 hours a day in front of a screen, primary school boys, it's 58.9%. Girls is only 48%, which is less than half, which is good. Well, which is not so bad, should I say. But in high school, boys is a horrifying 80.3%, and girls is 68.1%, which is far too much time wasted in front of television. Basically, watching television is an incredible waste of time. That's all it is. Most of it is not informative. It's simply a way of wasting your time, of getting through the day without having to think too much, without having to do too much. You learn very little, and it has very little value for a young person with a developing mind who really should be out there in the world learning real things, not just about characters and you know, actors and who can pretend to be what. And of course, all of this advertising, McDonald's and the like, shoving all of this unhealthy food into their faces during children's programming hours. It's all gone too far.
Well, speaking of parenting, we're often hearing about the Triple P Positive Parenting Program. It's heavily promoted by a number of counselling services in Australia. And it's interesting to note that although there have been some studies showing that children's behaviour improves after the program, so that parenting training does work, but to date there's been no study assessing if it actually works for fathers. Now, this is being rectified. There's a new report, the impact of behavioural parent training on fathers' parenting, a meta-analysis of the Triple P Positive Parenting Program. And this is by the authors are Richard Fletcher, Emily Freeman, and Stephen Matthey from the Family Action Centre Faculty of Health, University of Newcastle. We've had Richard Fletcher on the program before. He's written a very excellent book, The Dad Factor, which we can recommend. And he's released now this study on the effect on fathers. The study has been picked up by the US-based journal Fathering, which released an analysis of all the English language randomised control studies of Triple P, published before June 2011. The study examined the number of fathers compared to mothers, how many fathers stayed the distance, and what effect the program had on fathers and mothers' parenting. So if you Google Richard Fletcher or go to the University of Newcastle Faculty of Health Family Action Centre, you should be able to pick up some information on that program, which is very widely promoted in Australia, and now there's a little bit of research going into seeing what the effect actually is. Now, I might just flag what we're going to be doing in next week's show. Next week's show is going to be the last one for the year, so it's going to be a huge show, and we invite you all to listen.
A mega extravaganza of Dads on the Air.
And it will be.
Absolutely.
And, we'll be speaking to Robert Whiston, who's a blogger from Westminster, England, and the author of a recent article, Norgrove and McIntosh's Junk Science. Now, what he's referring to in particular there, apart from our own Jen McIntosh and her influence in the UK, is the recent Norgrove report. This is a report that was reported to the Family Justice Review Panel, and this is a legislative update in the UK of child custody laws and the family law courts. And unfortunately, it continues the country's long-term discrimination against fathers and children. This Norgrove himself, he has no expertise in family law. I don't believe he's had any experience. He's a businessman who was engaged by the Tory government over there to do a report. And it's quite extraordinary. He's come out and said that the child does not have a right to know both parents. He's focused on, as usual, on the alleged violence, never mind that mothers commit twice the abuse and neglect of children that fathers do, never mind that children don't want to lose one parent in the divorce process due to the court's obsession with sole child custody outcomes, never mind that studies show that children want and need both parents in their lives post-divorce, and never mind that the current child custody system accomplishes the opposite by effectively separating children from their fathers. So in the decision by this Norgrove report, and the recommendation is to the government, is just to leave it all as it is. They deal with the visitation rights of fathers and the children to see their fathers by referring them to Skype. And now Skype is hardly a way of building up the relationship between the father and his child. But
I guess it's better than nothing, though. I mean, at least you get to see them, you know. But I mean, it doesn't sort of compare with one-on-one, you know, physical contact. You know, getting to hold your dad's hand. You know, giving your dad a kiss. I mean, you know, seeing him on a computer screen. Yeah, well, it's better than nothing.
Yes, and of course it's all controlled by the residential parent, so they can turn the TV off or the computer off, or they're not available this week. So it's all it's not going the right way in the UK.
Certainly isn't.
And it's being pushed along, as I say, by our own Jen McIntosh, who's done enough damage in Australia. But we'll be hearing in greater detail next week when we speak to Robert Whiston on this whole topic of the Norgrove report and the influence of Jen McIntosh. His a recent article is titled "Norgrove and McIntosh's Junk Science." So we'll be looking forward to speaking to Robert Whiston next week.
Okay, well, we might just go to a quick track and we'll be back with our first guest.
On talking till I can't go on. While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out. We can work it out. Think of what you're saying. You can get it wrong and still you think that it's alright. Think of what I'm saying. We can work it or say goodnight. We can work it out. We can work it out. Life is very short and there's no time for fussing and fighting, my friend. I have always thought that it's a
grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in distress. 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
And welcome back to Dad's on the Air. And our guest this morning is psychologist and author Dr. Elizabeth Chelley. Elizabeth is an award-winning speaker and media commentator on men's mental health and masculinity, and through regular TV and radio appearances and interviews, workshops, seminars and publications, Dr. Chelley has helped to debunk the negative myths and stereotypes about men, our fathers, husbands, uncles, grandfathers, sons and brothers. Now, Elizabeth has produced a new book. It's only launched last week at a very successful launch in Melbourne. And the book is called Breaking the Silence, A Practical Guide for Male Victims of Domestic Abuse. Elizabeth, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And I'm glad we've been able to break into your busy timetable to just tell us a little bit about your new book.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you guys, Bill. No problem at all. Thanks for having me on.
No, that's great. Well, look, the book I found was great because you get straight into it really from the first page, and it's not it's not overly technical for the average Joe out there, the people who read your first book, or the regular Joe, should I say? But it's a very practical book as well. I mean, it starts off.
Yeah.
I know in the first chapter it's "Do male victims exist?" And that seems to be a hurdle at the very first hurdle, doesn't it? That people don't think it actually exists.
Yeah, absolutely, Bill. I still have an amazing surprise when I mention some of the work I do or this book. And even just last night at a meeting, having a woman say, "What? Female perpetrators? What do you mean?"
Mm.
And so that opened up quite a bit of discussion. I certainly do get into it from the very first page. We've already lost enough time on this topic, so it's time we just pierce through some of the veils and the misconceptions, break the silence, and certainly keep it practical and real. We are very much respect and admire masculinity, and so keeping it practical, pragmatic, down to earth. You know, I have a conversation with some men reading the book and any concerned family and friends that are reading the book, because it's there as a tool and a resource to now not only break the silence but raise a lot more awareness and get accurate information about this topic, mostly so men can start rebuilding their lives and get on track with their kids and their lives. So it's a very important topic.
Yes, and I guess the people's eyes start opening when you mention the statistics that are freely available from reputable sources like the Australian Bureau of Statistics. And,
absolutely. Did I interrupt you then?
No. I was just interested in if you could tell us about those statistics and what the real figures are.
Yeah, I actually read them over a few times myself because they're actually there in black or white, where you've actually got some interesting numbers where it was the personal safety survey that the 2005 one that I'm referring to here, where of near 80,000 Australian men reporting being assaulted by a female perpetrator, 77% of those assaults actually occurred in a home. And so when you break it down, 27% of those assaults were by a female partner and 45% by a female family member or female friend. And when he goes home, there's the risk of being assaulted other than the risks of what he already faces out in public spaces. What I also actually found quite interesting in reviewing the data is that obviously we'll hear a lot about female victims and male perpetrators, and fair enough, that's an unfortunate reality occurring there as well. But even in that same personal safety survey, where 38% of women report being assaulted by a male partner, a very near number of 33% of women reported being assaulted by a female stranger. Plus 33% of women reporting being assaulted by a female friend or female member. And so we've seriously got to have a look at this problem with female aggression and abuse. And in the case of the book I've written, very much touching on men, given they're the neglected victim. You know, we'll often hear about female victims, and yet with this issue of female aggression and abuse on men and women, men are still overlooked, undermined, disbelieved or ridiculed. And so I'm very much enthusiastic to make sure that those misconceptions are broken, as though men don't experience the hurt and pain by female perpetrators, which is simply inaccurate and simply untrue.
Yes. So is this, what drove you into this area of being a champion for men's welfare, because you found this was rife in the community?
That's partly the reason. I mean, my clinical experience was certainly showing me that. So working clinically as a psychologist in private practice for the last 8 years, both in a regional and a city area, particularly after the release of my first book, Regular Joe vs. Mr. Invincible, which we've spoken about before, that certainly opened up men's trust to be able to come and see me as a psychologist. And throughout a lot of that, of seeing male clients, of which I still see male and female, but certainly a lot more men coming to help themselves through psychological therapy, which is fantastic. But also many discussions that had opened up with other men's health workers, terrible work. There's other people even working in the domestic violence industry, but obviously focused on female victims, saying, yes, I've seen this problem a lot with male victims, but we just don't seem to talk about it, and there's not the same level of information and resources out there. And so we're facing this from a variety of areas, and coming across it so frequently, and particularly starting to actually see a lot of male clients. But as we started to go through whatever issues they came in to attend, we'd do a review and an assessment of their personal and family life, and really noticed they were in quite toxic relationships with their female partner, and that a lot of the behaviours, verbal statements, the developing pattern that was emerging, that actually he may have been experiencing abusive behaviour by his partner. Now, that doesn't mean she's necessarily hitting him. It made it all the more harder to detect for him, because unless there's this tangible physical violence, which unfortunately also occurs from female perpetrators, he would often miss abusive tendencies that I then talk about in the book of verbal abuse, verbal violence, emotional abuse, sexual manipulation, or leveraging the kids as means to either manipulate, intimidate, or control him, or threaten him somehow. And so when you start piecing the various things that occur over a day and over a week, patterns were actually emerging that, as a psychologist, I'd then say, have you considered perhaps this to be abusive behaviour? Because that certainly isn't normal, productive, appropriate behaviour in an intimate relationship. And so we'd explore that a lot, and he'd start to realise he'd actually become quite battered by those experiences. A lot of it seeps under the skin before you even realise what's going on. And the men themselves were even a bit surprised, going, no, that couldn't be possible. How could I possibly be abused by my wife or my partner? It just doesn't happen to men. Mm-hmm. And so really start to realise that actually we've crossed the threshold of what's appropriate and productive behaviour here, and what you're describing seems to be appropriate and unproductive, and it's having an effect on your mental health. And so slowly but surely they realise. So it's quite a undercurrent going on, that a lot of people are now realising, oh, actually, now that you mention it, that is a lot abusive, isn't it?
Yes,
so that's a great starting point.
Yeah, and you do go into some detail about the psychological abuse as distinct from the physical abuse and violence, and that's probably where a lot of it is going on, which is, as you say, much harder to pick than a black eye.
Well, as a psychologist, I think it's very important to highlight the intangible abuse that has a very tangible effect on someone's mental health and quality of life, because it's easy to detect bruises, punches, pinches. They're tangible physical evidence of violence, and certainly very harmful and debilitating. And yet the intangible abuse that occurs in words, in emotional tone, in incessant criticism, demeaning, denigrating, or threatening in means that aren't easy to detect as possible threats. And when they're a one-off, you can sometimes just flip them off as a one-off. But when they happen every so often, or they happen with enough intent of control, power, and intimidation, it can have quite a significant impact on someone's psychology. So you're better than a psychologist just informing and raising awareness about that, because it is so intangible and yet so debilitating, and so important for men to start realising where they may be, so to speak, in quotations, accepting unacceptable behaviour without realising that actually you don't need to live like that, and you do deserve to be treated with some basic courtesy and civility. And even when there is an argument, there are productive ways that you can argue safely and without your mental health being battered over a period of time. So it's quite a learning process, but certainly an empowering one. And as many men start to realise what's been going on, and a lot of in the practical guidance I provide step by step through the book in looking at the various areas to ensure he can safely deal with the situation and rebuild his life. And that is a step by step process. So, as I warn men in the book, unfortunately, it's not a one stop shop solution, which would be nice. The dynamics of abuse are far bigger than that, but they are certainly manageable, and there are certainly ways that you can get yourself back on track and keep yourself and your kids safe and rebuild your life again.
Yes, because the men get caught up in these myths as well. I know you've got a section here dedicated to at least you've picked out about 10 of these myths that are very hard to eradicate, aren't they? I think you've listed one here: men are always aggressors or initiators in domestic violence disputes. False.
I
was just with Right Ribbon Campaign was on only about a week ago, and I was amazed to speak to an ambassador who you'd think would have done a little bit of homework, and he came out with the extraordinary statistic that he thought was right. There's that of domestic violence, 97% of it was a male against a female, and
it's interesting. You really need to review the statistics that people are reviewing and quoting. And one of the key things I've noticed in this era, which one of the chapters in the book then goes through, is really having expertise and understanding of how research is designed, how the studies are actually implemented, and then how they're discussed and critiqued in an objective manner. And then the next step, when people start to use that research and quote it, and it's very important we be aware of people quoting that research out of context or quoting a certain number, say, for example, the one you just mentioned of 97%, and yet when you go back and read the paper, there's a whole bunch of context or caveats around it that weren't mentioned that make a big difference. And so, like I mentioned before, of reading, double checking when I was reading the Australian Bureau of Statistics Personal Safety Survey, going, hang on, I am reading this in black and white, but am I missing something here as to the context of this data? And in my own review, I couldn't find anything that I was missing. And having done a PhD and just steeped in research for a good 10 to 11 years, you certainly get ingrained with those skills to make sure you critique research objectively. And so, that's an area we need to be aware of. And it's certainly not denying that there are statistics and research that female victims are certainly hurt by male perpetrators. There's, of course, no denying of that. And that work there needs to continue. It's when the numbers are unfortunately used either out of context or they're amplified to induce fear. And this is a concern I really have in certain use of statistics in this area, where it induces unnecessary fear in women in particular, and unnecessary, demonising of men,
yes.
For want of a better word,
yes.
Of really making it appear a lot more unsafe than it is. Of course, we have to be careful, but to induce more fear in women, that actually, paradoxically, actually keeps women in a victim role. That keeps women in an anxiety state that I actually feel it's quite unethical to keep women in such an anxiety state unnecessarily. Like I said, of course, you have to be careful anywhere that we go, but it's not as bad as people make out. So we need to be very careful of that and not go to the extent of then this constant information going out to the first point that you made of these myths and misconceptions that need to be debunked. Now, naturally, where female victims were 3 to 4 decades ago in terms of the silent phenomena of domestic violence, this is where we are in the 21st century now. And so that silence from many decades ago has had much, much social awareness and social education done to ensure that it's not as silent anymore and that appropriate help is given to female victims. Now, what's occurred from that is that because it's only ever been so one-sided about female victims and male perpetrators, we have had decades of this information constantly coming our way, and again, fair enough, but the problem it's created in our mindset is a bit of a blind spot that it can only ever be female victims and male perpetrators. And so now when we mention male victims and female perpetrators, you get that surprise look because people have to actually just jump a hurdle in that blind spot to start opening up their awareness, opening up their eyes, opening up their ears to start listening to this information.
Yes, now, I think you point out in the book that the uh, that the pendulum has perhaps swung too far from the feminist revolution. And I like the way you were just saying then, now that women are starting to feel fearful. I mean, the whole feminist movement was to get women to be doing more things and to get out there, and
yeah.
so that people like yourself can get into professional positions and have an influence
Absolutely.
In the community. But now it's gone the other way, hasn't
it? Well, like I've mentioned at my launch, Bill, was the feminist movement was certainly needed. I mean, for where it was many decades ago, had I lived during that time, I wouldn't be doing the kind of thing that I'm doing now with the kind of ease that I'm doing it now. And so I and certainly many other female colleagues are very grateful for the feminist movement and what it needed to do to shift an imbalance in the opposite direction. But as I mentioned at the launch, it's not feminism that's the problem as such. It's misguided feminism. It's a fundamental kind of feminism that's now riding off the wave of feminism and swinging the pendulum too far and actually making life a living hell for women these days, where we're almost embarrassed to be associated with feminism, or we're judged because we might be out there just to be against men, which is not the case. And so it's more that misguided feminism that I'm referring to that distorts information, distorts data, raises unnecessary anxieties, and unfortunately then starts to counteract the benefits that were coming out of the feminist movement for both women and men. But of course men have needed to adjust just given there's been a social pendulum swing, but certainly taking it too far, that we need to be very careful of that misguided fundamental extreme space that it's gone into.
Yes, we're speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Celli, the author of a recently released book, Breaking the Silence, A Practical Guide for Male Victims of Domestic Abuse. And Elizabeth, the big message in your book, though, is that in the face of all this, you actually can, men can piece their life together and they can get back to a state where they are appreciated and move forward.
Absolutely. I'm very hopeful of that always, and I've helped many male clients through that, and I've also helped many females coming in that have realised their behaviour is abusive. So when you start shifting some of the behaviours and boundaries, and people start firstly getting a bit more aware of where the line in the sand of acceptable to unacceptable behaviour is, and then start implementing some productive skills in verbally defending themselves, in addressing certain levels of that, which I detail in the book step by step, you certainly can start to piece your life together. It is important, you know, in each chapter that unfolds that through the book, that you really take a look at each step, reflect on yourself, and no one's going to know your situation better than you. But it's important you have a coach by your side, and by a coach I mean a psychologist, because they're completely objective to your situation and most certainly can help you see the bigger dynamics, because depending on the level of concern with female person, how safe or unsafe the situation is, a psychologist can certainly assist you to have a look at where the new awareness and practical, pragmatic steps you can take have its pros and cons in the context of your situation and help you avoid other consequences, avoid any potential mistakes, help you with your frustration, help you with the difficulties that you'll naturally be facing, because it's an unfair and a bad situation, and it's understandable that you feel frustrated and resentful and bitter. And yet, you know, the assistance of a psychologist to help you not only work through that, but apply some pragmatic options and solutions in a safe and productive way to avoid any other consequences is certainly something I'm very mindful of for people. I want men to be able to rebuild their lives and do so in a way that they're not having to clean up any other mess.
Yes, I know. I always feel there are psychologists and psychologists, and if you get the wrong one, there's a risk that it may do more harm. But at page 102, you very helpfully have listed some questions to ask, so that
you've read the whole book already.
I have read the book, every word, and
I'm very mindful.
I like the I like very much the questions that people can ask the psychologist to make sure that they're going to get the guidance that they really need. As I say, I mean, if you get the wrong one, it could do more harm than good. But
Can I just make a comment on that, Bill? In that, like we were saying before, many people are just genuinely surprised. It's not because they don't want to believe it, but they're just genuinely surprised. And certain health professionals are exactly in that position as well. With some of their training or their experience or exposure to this topic, many want to help male victims and have been at a bit of a loss as to how can I best help him most productively. So there's that avenue. And then, unfortunately, there's just many that, because we've been so steeped in the female victim, male perpetrator approach, that's what they know and haven't explored other options. So it's been the case at times when I've had to refer some of my male clients to other professionals or service providers because it's going to help their situation, that I'm also assisting with some of that screening of other professionals to check what their experience is or their perspective is. So for empowering men to be able to really take the bull by the horns for themselves, you know, there is it's a practical guide. I'm very mindful of how I could be ethically practical with some guidance that could help men really take personal control back for themselves, not control over anyone else naturally, but personal control to empower themselves and really feel this isn't hopeless, you're not helpless in this. Yes, there might be a few struggles or some invisible walls to get through, but they're not insurmountable, it's not impossible. And you can take personal control to really contribute to every step with your team and coach by your side as appropriate. So yeah, I'm glad you found that useful, because it's exactly the men of the family that I want to find that useful as well.
Yes, and I think you relate to men very well by having a section where it's like a coaching manual, a tennis coaching manual.
Yeah.
And you've even, as I say, there's a box here with the summaries of the do's and don'ts, so that it's yeah, very, very plain, and although at a time of great emotion you might be struggling to have these word for word, but if you've got this in the back of your mind, you know, you don't like the first very first one is, you know, you in an argument like this, you don't call her irrational, over the top, and say it's not that bad or the like, because that's going to just perhaps inflame the situation in that emotional situation.
Yeah, having worked with male victims for a few years now, I'm very mindful of the battered psychology that can happen, and it gets very confusing. It's a washing machine in the psychology space, the mental space, the emotional space, quite naturally, because of what you're experiencing. It's distressing and it's overwhelming. And so I was mindful to make sure that this book could be used as a reference guide. So if you want to put dog ears or you put your little post-it notes, you can flip through those pages and get some quick reminders along the way whenever you hit a low point as you're on your journey moving forward. So, you know, I enjoy working with men, obviously, and it's a strength I make sure that they can have that pragmatic, practical approach, because I appreciate how men approach things. In assisting themselves, but at the same time alerting them that in this situation, sometimes that might work against you in the initial stages. So there's just one or two steps you need to consider beforehand, and then you can apply that stuff to much more productive end without creating any other mess or consequences you'll need to clean up that you didn't foresee. So having the benefits of foresight with my work and awareness of this topic, I really hope that comes across for them to be able to gain from that and regain their personal control, rebuild their lives, and most certainly maintain good relationship and safety with their kids.
Yes, and look, there are so many practical tips in this book. I haven't really got time to go through them all, but
that's okay. People will have to buy the book.
They
will
have to buy the book, because there's another excellent section is, do I stay or do I go? It's a perennial question for men in these situations. You know, what is the best thing to do? Well, in this book, Elizabeth sets out the considerations and makes recommendations. It's not, obviously it'd be better to have a personal discussion, but it just gives you that guidance and tells you that it's not all lost. And Elizabeth, you're looking at the future. I wonder if you could just sum up where, if people listen to your message, and where do you see that we'll get to in the future, maybe 100 years from now?
100 years from now, there'll be some partnerships where you can have a fair fight and a fair argument. It will still be respectful and civil, and people won't be abusing each other. But most importantly, men will also not be as denigrated as they are now, and women will be able to enjoy magnificent sharing with men, if you're talking hundreds of years away. You know, the benefits of masculinity and the benefits of femininity come together in a manner that empowers, so that you've got power with each other rather than power over each other. So it's most certainly helping men step into their space as their own man, and being able to have a fabulous relationship with their children and their partner, of course, as long as both parties take responsibility for any unproductive behaviour, particularly female perpetrators. I would hope socially that we very much balance out this picture that abuse is abuse, regardless of gender. Male victims certainly deserve to feel safe, and female perpetrators also need to be accountable to their behaviour. And so the way we all need to take responsibility in this case, we need to rebalance that pendulum to make sure it's not going too extreme to the detriment of anyone, and in this case, men who've been overlooked, unfortunately, for far too long. So, that's some vision that I have for the future, but at this point, it's helping men get back on their feet, resume some personal control, rebuild their life, and take some productive steps forward to safety, good quality of life, and great mental health, because it's the thing that helps them through every day, so they can have some fantastic relationships with the people around them and enjoy life. What we all want.
Yeah, look, on that on that positive note, Elizabeth, I think we've run out of time, but we've been speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Celli, who's the author of this new book, Breaking the Silence, A Practical Guide for Male Victims of Domestic Abuse. It's published by Global Publishing, and it will be available at your local bookshop. Thoroughly recommend it, with numerous practical tips for people who are in this situation or at risk of getting this situation or just want to know a bit more about the whole topic. So, Elizabeth...
Sorry if I can mention to you, if anyone wants to have live chats on this, I will be doing two webinars next week on this very topic, next Tuesday and Thursday, so just go to my website to have a look at the details of that, drcelli.com.au.
drcelli.com.au, and it's Celli is spelled C-E-L-I.
C-E-L-I, that's right. So you'll see the next webinar red button on the homepage. Just click on that and you'll get a listing of the dates of the webinars. So register in there and you can have a live chat. If there's any questions you can ask, if you just want to listen, you can just listen. And through that, you can also get a copy of the book, depending on how you register. So that's an option available for any of the listeners if they like.
That's great. Well, Elizabeth, thank you very much for being on the program, and we wish you all the best in your work and continuing success with your books. So thanks again.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye, Elizabeth.
Bye.
Too long blonde hair and your eyes are blue. The only thing I ever got from you was sorrow. Sorrow. You're acting funny, trying to spend my money. Get out there playing high-class games of sorrow. Sorrow. You never do what you know you ought to. Something tells me you're the devil's daughter. Sorrow. Sorrow.
so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And welcome back to Dads on the Air this 6th day of December 2011. And our guest is Emily Tilbrook, a psychologist and researcher at Edith Cowan University in Perth and the lead author of the Intimate Partner Abuse of Men report that was released in about June 2010. Emily, good morning.
Good morning.
And thank you for getting up bright and early to speak to us today.
Yes, it's quite early over here in Perth, actually, on our wild weather.
Oh, yes. Emily, we actually spoke to Greg Deer about the time one of your co-writers in this book in about, I think it was June 2010. Perhaps as well as if you could tell us something about the study, I'm wondering if there have been any developments since it was released.
Since it was released, we had a lot of feedback on the research at the time because we did workshops and a formal launch on the topic. So we had a lot of feedback from people working in the industry as well. We're also working on obviously producing some journal articles as well on the research. So that's really where we're at the moment, is trying to get all of that information out there so it becomes a much more available to a much more international audience, I suppose.
Yes, internationally.
Yeah.
So it's perhaps raising awareness internationally of these same issues and objectives that you were wanted to achieve in your report.
Yeah, obviously there's researchers over in America and the UK, and I think there's been quite a few in the Netherlands as well that have done some research on this topic. But this is really one of the first ones in Australia. There has been a couple in Australia, but they haven't looked at this topic in the same way that we have. So it's really quite groundbreaking for Australia, I suppose.
Yes, and the topic, as I mentioned, was intimate partner abuse of men.
Yes.
Is there a distinction between intimate partner abuse and family violence?
I guess the distinction that we make is that intimate partner abuse is that abuse that occurs just between an intimate couple, so someone in a de facto or a married relationship or even in a dating relationship, whereas family abuse covers all aspects of abuse that occurs within families, so it can include child abuse, it can include elderly abuse, as well as intimate partner abuse. So in my concept, family abuse is a much broader definition than what intimate partner abuse is. Intimate partner abuse is much more specific because it's on the couple themselves.
Okay, and is there a difference between abuse and violence?
I think so, yeah. Sorry, I'm just getting a bit of feedback on the phone. The feedback's quite distracting. Oh. The difference to me would be that abuse covers things like psychological violence. It also covers emotional abuse, social abuse, whereas violence tends to be more the physical aspects. And a lot of the time when people think about violence, that's what they think of as the physical aspects. But abuse covers a much broader understanding of what can occur in relationships, especially in the home environment.
So. Yes. And now, the main objective in your study was to gather data in improving services to male victims of intimate partner abuse. Do you believe you met that objective in the report?
I think so. I guess what we... It's because it's such new research in Australia, what we actually really were looking at was what men's experiences were in relation to intimate partner abuse, so what sort of forms of abuse they experience, the impacts of the abuse on them, and their experiences talking about their abuse, the abuse that they experience as well. So in terms of service provision, they were the main aspects that we focused on, was that experience of talking about, you know, disclosing what had happened to them. So we came up with a number of barriers or facilitators to disclosure. So we don't actually necessarily have data about treatment of men, but we have data about how you might engage men in the treatment process, which is quite difficult for men because there's a lack of services out there, of course.
Yes, there's a lack of services, and I guess there's a reluctance to actually talk about the what's been going on.
Absolutely. That was one of the biggest findings of our research as well, was that there's a huge reluctance in men themselves to actually talk about their experience, and I'm sure that Elizabeth's probably spoken to you about that a bit this morning as well.
Yes, we spoke to Dr. Elizabeth Celli, and I know she drew on your research in writing her new book, Breaking the Silence.
Yeah, it's some of the biggest barriers for men is that there's this perception from the men that society don't see intimate partner abuse occurring when the man is a victim and where a female can be a perpetrator. So because of that perception, they're reluctant to talk about it because they perceive that others won't believe their story. I think that's one of the biggest things. And it's and in some ways it's a bit of, by admitting that they're a victim, they believe that, you know, people will think that they're less of a man as well.
Yes, and there's some justification for that belief. I mean, some of the reception they might get, say, from a police station might be less than encouraging for them to come forward.
Yeah, and there's a few men in who participated in our research that actually had very similar experiences. That one of them actually got laughed at by a police officer when he disclosed the violence that was happening to him. So that it's... It's not just that they have that perception, they have actually had an experience where that's occurred as well.
Yes, I mean, there was a court case, I think, where the magistrate said to a man he should man up. You know, it's it's just a reluctance to believe that it's going on. And I think you also, I'm sure you had a number of surprises when you were doing the research, but there was a new form of abuse, which I was interested in this, which you labelled the legal administrative abuse.
Yes.
And this seems to be one where sometimes women, whether it's in their hard wiring or somehow they seem to just know how to get the best out of the legal system, and if it goes that far to get into court, and then they can this is another form of abuse.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually an interesting one, and I do wonder whether it happens the other way around as well. Yeah. You know, where it happens where men might use the systems against women as well, but. Obviously, that's not what our research was about. Our research was about men's experience of it, and it was actually such a strong theme that came out in our data. A lot of the men spoke about that and where they would either be in family court and their wife would get a VRO out on them so that they wouldn't be able to get access to their children, or sometimes even just through use of services such as DCP and... I mean, that's what we call over here, which is Department of Child Protection. I'm not sure what it's called in Sydney. Those sorts of services as well. So it was outside the legal sphere as well. It was in the engagement of all sorts of services, counselling services, that sort of thing, where there would be an accusation made that the man had been the abusive partner rather than the woman, and it was actually the other way around. So,
yes. Yes, it's, we call it docs over here. It's infamous in New South Wales.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
they're always understaffed. There are numerous reports into the failings of docs.
It sounds very similar to over here.
An interesting abuse which you mentioned as being found with only one participant was spiritual abuse. I was wondering how that would work.
Yeah, that was we only had one participant that actually talked about that, but essentially that was where. He was, from memory, was a Catholic. Sorry, I'm going off the top of my head here. Mm. But from memory, he was Catholic. And he saw his role as a Catholic provider and father and wife to be, you know, strong and, you know, in control of the situation and all that sort of stuff. And his family and his wife... sort of criticised him for not fulfilling that role, I suppose. So he wasn't also allowed to engage in his religious experience at times as well. And that's one of the other ways that spiritual abuse can be enacted, I suppose, is that they're not allowed to engage in their spiritual beliefs. they're restricted from that, or they're criticised for their spiritual beliefs. But we didn't really have a lot of data on that in relation to men, but there was one man that spoke about that.
And I'm just looking at some of these findings. The data suggests that women who reportedly abuse their intimate male partners are likely to abuse other people as well. So it's, you know, perhaps the men can take some comfort that it's not just me, it's, you know, it's the person that's got the problem.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing to take comfort in, isn't it? It extended to, mostly it was children who experienced the abuse as well, and other family members like sisters of the male victim and mothers of the male victim, from memory. But also there was a few of the men whose partners actually had violence restraining orders against them from other people, if that makes sense. So the female partner had someone else who had gotten a violence restraining order against her, and there was actually one partner, one of the women, that one of the men spoke about, who had three violence restraining orders against her from other people, not other men, other females, from memory. So, yeah. And, I mean, there was a lot of data as well on what sort of could be the possible causes for women abusing men, what men felt were the possible reasons why this was happening. And a lot of them actually came up with sort of mental health issues on behalf of their female partner. So that was an interesting finding as well, I suppose.
And we're speaking with Emily Tilbrook, who's a psychologist and researcher at Edith Cowan University in Perth, and the lead author of a study, Intimate Partner Abuse of Men Report. So in the time since the report's come down, I mean, you made a number of recommendations, and one was that the government should fund public awareness campaigns of intimate partner violence against men. Has there been any movement at government level that you're aware of in this area?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I think that I'm not sure if you're aware that the research was actually funded by Lottery West, but we also had we were engaged with the Men's Advisory Network in conducting the research, which is a Perth-based advisory network for males to help with all sorts of issues. And Gary Bryant, who runs the Men's Advisory Network, he's working towards advocating for those sorts of positions, but as far as I'm aware, none of that's been successful at this stage. So.
No, it doesn't have the backing of, say, the White Ribbon campaign or some of these other movements.
Yeah, which was actually on last week, wasn't it? White Ribbon campaign, yeah.
I think it was last week. And it's a very easy one to jump onto, whereas the area you're getting into for a number of reasons we've been talking about is a hard one, isn't it? To raise the will and the knowledge of about it. But I guess what you're doing is so important, because at least it's getting some genuine research, and hopefully people will be guided by the facts rather than the prejudice.
Yeah, it's providing some data for people to be able to put a case forward, I suppose. And there's a lot of resistance to the public awareness campaigns for men that I've experienced, I suppose. And I, to some extent, I understand the reasoning behind the resistance, but at the same time, the reasoning, I guess, is that there's so limited funding for these services in general that there's a fear that if services are extended towards men, then the funding will be cut even more. I guess the issue for me is that even if there's only, you know, there's a lot of arguments about the prevalence of male victims as well, but even if there was only a small percentage of male victims, they still deserve to be treated. You know, you're not going to ignore something like leukemia, which, you know, causes significant distress to people. This also causes significant distress, so not something that should be ignored either.
Yes, and that seems to be a frequent argument that that by promoting services for men, you're going to somehow decrease the services for women. We're really everyone that's in need should have the services available.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
So that's something to aim for. And you mentioned that you'd struck some resistance. What sort of resistance did this take?
It's an interesting one. There was a lot of resistance in regards to the recommendation that we made about public awareness campaigns, because there was a few people who made comments that it would detract away from, you know,
female victims, and it would give too many men the opportunity, men who were actually abusing, the opportunity to say, oh, no, but I've been a victim too. But I think there's this fear out there that that's the sort of situation that will occur and no one will really understand what's happening in that intimate relationship, and that accusations will be made on both sides and it'll just get really messy. I guess the reality is that if this is occurring, which there's plenty of data to suggest that it is occurring, then that has to be looked at, you know. Mm. Every situation, every individual relationship has to be looked at on its own merits to see what's really going on. If you say, for example, taking it to a family court case or something like that, you have to look at the whole dynamics of the relationship.
And you personally, being the first name mentioned with the report, have you been subject to any personal attacks as a result of the report?
No, I don't think so. It was an interesting experience during the workshop on the report. There was a lot of comments made about men not experiencing fear. I guess that was one of the biggest things that came out in that, is that they felt that men don't experience fear in the same way that women do, or to the extent that women do, which is why it's not necessarily as significant for men to be a victim. But I think our research actually supports the view that men do experience fear, and it's a very significant experience for them. So really, other than criticisms of the report in that sense, or criticisms of the research in general, I haven't actually received any personal attacks about this, no.
Yeah. And did you study the method of the violence, like as the different types of violence in your report? Like, do women tend to use, whatever's handy, scissors, knives, guns, whatever, as against men using their fists or their physical abuse?
We didn't look at it in a quantitative manner, so we didn't sort of categorise it in that way. What we did was actually do it qualitatively, so we got men's stories. And there was certainly data that suggested that women, the men reported that women would use weapons as well. Some of the men talked about being scalded by boiling water. One of the men talked about having his ear bit. So there was a lot of those sorts of things, and throwing objects. A lot of men talked about having books thrown at them and that sort of thing.
Yes.
They were more likely to use a physical object rather than to... I wouldn't say they would be more likely to use a physical object rather than punching, but they were more likely to do more damage if they used a physical object than if they were punching, because obviously women don't necessarily have the strength behind them to punch as hard. Having said that, there were some men who had some wives who did have a lot of strength behind them as well, or partners that did have a lot of strength behind them and could do them a lot of damage.
Yes, you only need to know you can hit someone when they're not expecting it and can do a lot more damage. And also, I guess, when you're emotionally fraught, you suddenly get the adrenaline pumping, and that's a different story as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Emily, we're unfortunately running out of time. It's such an interesting topic. But could I thank you very much for being on the program today, and just adding to what Elizabeth said when she acknowledged the assistance you gave her in writing her book. We wish you all much strength in continuing your work, and it's very vital work. And thank you very much again for being on the program.
Yep, thanks very much.
It's Emily Tilbrook. Thanks, Emily.
Okay. Bye.
Today I stumble from my bed with thunder crashing in my head, my pillow's still wet from last night's tears. And as I think of giving up, a voice inside my coffee cup kept crying out, ringing in my ears. Don't cry, Daddy. Daddy, please don't cry. Daddy,
Daddy, you still got me and little Tommy. Together we'll find a brand new mommy. Daddy, Daddy, please laugh again. Daddy, ride us on your back again. Oh, Daddy, please don't cry. Why are children always first to feel the pain and hurt the worst? It's true, but somehow it just don't seem right. 'Cause every time I cry, I know it hurts my little children's soul. I wonder, will it be the same tonight? Don't cry, Daddy. Daddy, please don't cry. Daddy, you've still got me and little Tommy. Together we'll find a brand new mommy. Daddy, Daddy, please laugh again. Daddy, ride us on your back again. Oh, Daddy, please don't cry. Oh, Daddy, please. Don't cry.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
We're back for the last time today. We'd like to thank our guests, Dr. Elizabeth Chelly, the author of Breaking the Silence, A Practical Guide for Male Victims of Domestic Abuse, and Emily Tilbrook, who's a researcher at the Edith Cowan University in Perth. Don't forget, next week we've got a huge show. It's our last show for the year, and we'll be speaking to Peter Tromp, the chair of the Dutch Father Knowledge Centre and secretary of the Platform for European Fathers, on all the latest goings on in Europe. And we'll be speaking to Robert Whiston in the studio. We're going to have Benjamin von der Hem and Ken Thompson. Benjamin is from the Netherlands. He's the 2011 Father of the Year, as he's shared with Ken Thompson. So it'll be great to speak to those people in the studio and when we go to Europe. So a great show next week. We look forward to your company. In the meantime, it's bye for now from Bill Cable from Mediate Now and
Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com. And you can hear this program on dadsontheair.com.au.
Yeah, we're here 'cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.